Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 15 of the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodsick, and this interview is with Rose McAleese, who is a poet, a comedian, a rising star in LA, and one of my favorite friggin' people. She's written a collection of poetry called Strong Female Character that you should totally check out for yourself, and I would suggest giving it as a present for the young writer in your life. Rose will be hosting Seattle Poetry Slam's Grand Slam this Saturday, May 2nd at 8 p.m. That's at Town Hall Seattle, and I will link to the Facebook event in the episode description on the podcast's website. So check out some awesome slam poetry in Seattle and enjoy episode 15 with Rose McAleese. I'm joined on the podcast this episode with Rose McAleese.
Yeah.
Welcome, Rose. I'm glad you're here.
Me too. I'm really excited.
So, you were born on Halloween, huh?
Yes, I was. I was born on Halloween.
Tell me the story. Tell me your origin story from that moment.
My origin story. The funny thing is, I was talking to someone in LA where this is the first Halloween that I wasn't in Seattle. I was like in LA. And someone was like, oh, you're born on Halloween. Is your birthday always on Halloween? And I was like, it's not Thanksgiving. Like,
with the
or Easter.
Or Thursday,
right?
Or whatever.
Like,
yeah.
I was like, yes, my birthday is on Halloween.
Always on Halloween.
But I was there. I was 9 pounds, 13 ounces.
Big baby.
My mom was in labor for 10 minutes. Like,
what?
She was like, she was in labor, but she pushed me out in 10 minutes. Like, they were like, the baby's coming. And she was like, oh, I got this. Because my sister was 7 pounds, and so my mom was like, this baby won't be nothing. But then I was the world's fastest 10-minute, 10-pound baby, pretty much.
That's amazing. And you've written, I remember reading a bio of yours that maybe that has some influence on your work, your birth date. What, talk about that a little bit.
It's basically, Halloween has been the, just has foreshadowed my entire existence in this world. That it's all, you know, it's all, like, funny and weird that, of course, I was born on Halloween. Like, I'm not someone that's really into astrology. I guess I'm a Scorpio, which means I'm jealous but great in bed, so I'm okay with that. I'm great with both those things. But, yeah, I feel like being born on Halloween just kind of gave me such a weird, dark humor, I guess. It's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you are a poet. You are many things,
many.
But let's start with your poetry. Can you remember the first time you wrote a poem and you're like, damn, I am good at this?
Oh, I think I was maybe, I was 7 or 8, and my parents, I was wildly obsessed with Shakespeare. I was just like, oh, I love
right.
him. He gets me. 8-year-old Rose being angsty, reading like Hamlet and being like, I'm the female Hamlet. My parents being like, what did we create? What monster is this? But yeah, so it was, I think I was like 7 or 8. I was obsessed with, you know, Shel Silverstein, you know, Dr. Seuss. My mother introduced me to my Angelou and other great poets, and I just kind of got into it, and I feel like it was such a cheesy poem. I feel like they're all cheesy when you're 8 years old. All the crappy stuff I got
right.
out quick.
Right.
But it was a poem about, like, being depression and how it's locked in the bottom of an ocean, and I don't know. My parents still have the poem. I wrote it when I was 8 years old, and for my elementary school, they thought it was great, and they, like, had me read it at, like, town hall, and it was, like, this big ordeal, and I was like, oh, I could keep doing this. And it's, like, I can't remember. It's just such a cliche, like, poem, but it was adorable. It was really cute, but, yeah.
So then you had that momentum. Was the audience feedback part of what motivated you?
Yes and no. I feel like, you know, the whole idea, don't write for an audience, always comes into play, but it did. The gratification of knowing that, like, someone out there enjoyed my writing or enjoyed my poetry, I thought was really cool. That I was like, oh, it's not nerdy or geeky. Like, I can do this and people will admire me or, you know, encourage me, I think is the biggest
sure.
thing. But yeah, that was pretty much it.
When did you first start competing in poetry slams?
I started competing in poetry when I was 13 years old. It was the first slam I ever went to, and I was the youngest person competing, and it was 30 poets. And I just remember I went, and it was at Langston Hughes Community Center. It was for You Speak Seattle. So the origin story of why I started doing poetry is that I was failing 7th grade, absolutely horribly failing 7th grade, was angsty, was an angry white girl, just was kind of like, screw the world, you don't get me. like, I don't even get me yet. What do you expect? So I had a field trip that, like, took all the troubled youth, and we went to the Seattle Center House, basically.
Sure.
R.I.P. the Fun Forest doesn't exist anymore. And so we went, and basically during the like break, an organization called You Speak Seattle started doing a mini slam. And during the mini slam, my now mentor, Angela Day, got on stage and like literally jumped on the table and just did this amazing slam poem. And I was like, I need to know them. And sought them out, found them, gave me a flyer, which my father found and framed. I still have the flyer to this day. Found a flyer, Langston Hughes. And I basically went. And it was 30 people. I was the youngest person that competed. I went, wrote a poem that was just like, you don't know me. Like, it's tough being a white girl. Like, just some really bad, like, you know, I was really influenced by, like, Tal Kweli's Beautiful Struggle at the time, which was the album that, like, I felt like encapsulated my life. And so it was, like, this weird, weird, awful, bad poem. But, like, but I did it, and then... In the poetry community, you know, people snap, they give you your moans of sympathy. It was just one of those things that I was like, oh, like, I felt at home. Like, I felt good and, like, I felt beautiful and I felt like, worthy. And so it was just, it was awesome. And I competed. And, of course, I placed, like, you know, like, 17th place or something. Like, you know, barely made it, but, like, made it well enough. And then from that point on, it just, the rest, I guess, is history. I did it for 10 years. I retired when I was, like, 24. I retired last year. It's so funny to say that. But, like, I keep on saying, like, I'll pull, like, a Jay-Z or a Michael Jordan. Like, take the jersey off the wall and slam again. But, no, for the most part, I started when I was 13 and competed and lost and competed and lost and then made it on a team when I was 16. Had the pleasure of being on the team 16, 17, 18, and 19. Did the college team for University of Washington, even though I didn't go to the college. We jumped a lot of hoops for that. And then became an adult, which means 21 and over, and competed on that team for 2 years. Had the pleasure of coaching, mentoring, and here I am today as like a poet. It's crazy.
Can you talk about your first collection of poems, Strong Female Character, and how that book came into this world?
Strong Female Character is, in the poetry community, there's these things called chapbooks, which are like self-made, self-published books. You know, they're very small. They're usually kind of like folded pieces of paper and just delicately put together really beautiful things. The things that poets can do to chapbooks are amazing. I had never done a chapbook, ever. Entire existence of me being a poet, never did chapbook. And everyone was like, that's what you do. It's the mixtapes for poets, basically.
Right.
And so what I did is I started writing poems on pieces of paper and hiding them places across Seattle. I like, wove them between chain link fences and, like, Cal Anderson Park. I hid them on in bus stops. I hid them on movie seats. Like, I just hid poems across the city, and then I went to LA Bay Books and I put poems in my favorite books and had, like, people just stumble over them, and they're just, like, you know, short little poems. And a family friend of ours, Shasta, who's my now publisher from Litsum Publishing, shout out to Litsum, she saw this video that I made about me putting my poetry out there, and she was like, we should just publish it, let's just get them all together, make it something, and then publish it as a book. And, you know, of course, when you hear that, you're just like, okay, cool, we're gonna publish a book. And then they give you the first physical copy of the book, and you're like, I published a book. It's the weirdest thing in the world. Like, there's a book, like, you could Google me, and I'm on Amazon and, like, LA Bay Books. Like, I'm on the shelves of LA Bay Books. Not anymore, they sold out of my book. That's the
Congratulations.
Thing. Thank you. It's weird. But yeah, so I have a short, a book of poetry. I'm like a published author. What?
Can we talk about your blurbs? Because there's one very famous writer who blurbed your book.
I've never heard of him before. He blurbed my book. No, to ready for the heavy name dropping warning.
Yeah.
Tom Robbins. He is an absolute dear friend and mentor and pen pal.
How?
So I'm gonna own it. Nepotism is an amazing thing sometimes. You can pretend it. You can pull a Lena Dunham and act like nepotism never helped you. Nepotism is it's a good thing. My mother was really good friends with him growing up when Tom first moved to Seattle and was like discovering himself as a writer and becoming who he is today, basically. And he was dating a woman at the time named Jenny Ruffner, who's a famous glass artist in Seattle. And so that's how my mom met Jenny Ruffner. And her and my mom and Tom just kind of, I don't know how they met, but my mom was a journalist for the Seattle Weekly, and they just, I feel like, fell across each other and became friends. And then as I got older, Tom has always been a huge support, a huge mentor, really supportive, really big on wanting to help me and everything. So when I told him I had a book, he was like, send it to me. Send me a poem. He was like, I don't even need the whole book. Like, just send me a poem. And then he was like, send me more. And then I just sent him a book, the entire book, and he wrote that amazing blurb. And it boggles my mind. Like, it's weird. That A, I have a published book, and B, Tom wrote a blurb on it. It's crazy.
So how old were you when that book came out?
That book came out in 2012. I was 22.
Wow.
Yeah, is that weird? That's weird, right?
I think that's amazing.
That's
crazy. I think that's great.
Oh, I know, I always try to, it's such a generational thing. I always try to downplay it because I'm like, it's only a book of poetry. Like, I'm published, but it's only a book of poetry. But man, screw that. I got a published book.
Yeah, you do. And you have another one that is in the works.
Yes.
Called Words Can't Describe.
Words Can't Describe. That one came from, again, me being a smart ass. Sorry if I'm cussing, but me.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You can swear. The last, I'm recording two podcasts today, and there's a lot of F-bombs.
Oh, okay, good.
So you don't have to,
right.
But you can.
But I'm Irish. I have to. It's in my genes. No, so I was being a smart ass, and someone was like, write three words that describe you. And I came up with Words Can't Describe. And I just remember the teacher being like, really upset by that answer. It was like high school or something. And it was like a freshman orientation. And she was like, everyone come up with three words that like describe you. And I was like, words can't describe because I'm deep like that. And then I came across a lot of those poems I wrote when I was a freshman not too long ago and just kind of realized and then rewrote those poems. So I'm keeping the original poems I wrote when I was a freshman in high school and then the rewrites as 25-year-old Rose.
Nice.
Both
copies are in the
both
book?
Both copies will be in the book. If it works out perfectly, there's like four or five that are fall into that series of things. So it's 10 years. So it's 15-year-old Rose and 25-year-old Rose battling it out, I guess. So yeah, the next book of poetry is going to be Words Can't Describe. We're still, it's all collected. It just needs to be edited and sorted out.
What's your writing process like when you sit down to write a poem? Do poems, they come to you, you have to sit down and write them just then, or do you have a time of day where you're like, this is what I'm going to write, or not, or what?
It's always in traffic and right before I go to bed. Like, I don't know why, my muse is a slut. Like, I love her to death, but she seems to be visiting everyone else at really great times, and then just comes to me late at night, like, you up, girl? Oh, you are? Okay, cool. Let me bother you with all these really dope metaphors and thoughts and processes. I'm just like, I want to sleep. Let me go to bed. And then the worst is, like, when you're in traffic, because you're like,
what am I going to do?
What am I going to do? But I do now have, like, a notebook, like, in the door handle, basically, that I pull out and, like, scribble furiously, not getting in car accidents. I shouldn't admit that, but whatever. So I have that. But my process is kind of, I'm always inspired by music. I listen to music a lot of the time when I write. I'm always, always and forever inspired by other writers. Like, I don't understand writers who don't read. Like, if you don't, like, you know, one of the things I always ask writers when I interview them or meet them is, like, what book are you reading? What book do you recommend to a young reader? And I've interviewed a couple that are like, oh, I don't read. And I'm like, what? You're not a writer. You're just like a faker. It's such a disconnect that if you don't read as a writer, I think it's weird and strange. But I'm inspired by music, very inspired by other writers, very inspired by poetry. I just went to a youth slam last night and blown away. Oh my God, the kids that just competed, absolutely gorgeous human beings that blew me out of the water. I was so impressed and so touched, and it was absolutely amazing. So,
and that really goes to show and encouraging our listeners, you can't start too young writing poetry. Your first poem that you remember is seven years old, and there are opportunities, especially in Seattle, in this area.
Oh yeah. Like, there's not enough money for the arts, but there are enough programs. You know, Youth Speak Seattle is the organization that I owe everything to. And last night, prepare for another name drop.
Yeah.
My very good friend, Mary Lambert, who is now, a Grammy Award nominated.
And Hollis,
And
right?
Hollis Wongware. Two of my, Hollis basically raised Mary and I. She mentored us when we were young, and she coached us as poets. We're all the students of You Speaks. We all went through that program, and we had the absolute, I don't want to speak for them, but for myself, absolute privilege and honor to be part of that program and to be mentored by people who cared about us, to be loved and supported and told that our stories matter and our voices matter, and then taking what we learned and giving it to the next generation.
Paying it forward.
Yeah, paying it forward to the fullest. And so, yeah, it's just, you can never start too young. You're going to write horrible stuff. Everyone writes horrible stuff. That's the stuff you don't see. You hide it away. That's totally fine. That's why you have a notebook. You don't need to post everything on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter. Write as much crappy stuff as you can now. Get it out. Do your 10,000 hours. Like, I fully believe in that. And whenever someone's like, what advice do you give a youth poet? Three pieces of advice I give is host a slam, because it's always like really fun just to host a slam. Or it's like host and attend a slam. Just like go watch it. Either host one because it's a fun event to just host and like talk. Judge a poetry slam because it really puts you in a different perspective where, yes, it's really weird to judge art, but then it makes you question your own art as well as trying to figure out your relationship with competing with your poetry. That also kind of weaves out people that are like, oh, I just want to be a poet. I don't want to be a slam poet.
Right.
And then the last and final piece of advice is lose. Lose as much as you can. The best poets never win. I told a girl last night that was robbed, of course, because there's always people in the poetry center that get robbed. I told her, like, someone told me once when I was 13, the best poets never win. And it's true. You know, the poets that are going to go be on the team win, but sometimes the best poets never win. And you just have to lose a slam and keep losing, and you'll be surprised on how that just fires you up to, like, want to be better, to want to write better, to study more poets, to go on YouTube and check out as many videos as you can. Be so hungry and thirsty for inspiration. Just lose, and then that's the best form of winning in the long run. So, yeah.
I love that. I want to talk a little bit more about your process in writing. When you sit down, I know that you're retired, but...
Retired.
When you sit down to write a poem, do you know going in if it's going to be a slam poem or not a slam poem?
You know, I was talking to someone about that. The definition of a slam poem is a poem that demands to be performed, that it demands theatrics. That it's screaming lights, camera, action. So most of the time, when I write a poem, I always just assume that it's going to be a page poem. Whenever I sit down and put pen to paper, that's just what it is. Because my whole thing is, usually my process when I'm either commissioned to write a piece or asked to write a piece or even just writing one for myself, I journal. Just completely get all the bad thoughts or weird thoughts out. Just start writing about my day, the sounds I'm hearing when I'm writing, weird thoughts, write the word I can't write over and over again, and then once you get all the junk, you know, it's like a faucet. You have to turn on the faucet, you have to let the cold water get out first, and then the water starts warming up, and that's what it is. You're just waiting for the water to get warm. And you just write, and you just write, and you just write. So I never know until I'm able to, like, step back and look at it. And then when the editor comes in, once Poet Rose leaves and the editor walks in, I feel like that's when I can tell that it's going to be a slam poem or, like, a, you know, a spoken word piece versus, like, a page poem. The stage versus the page, which I hate because it rhymes, but, like, that's really what it is. It's page poetry and stage poetry.
When you were talking earlier about reading all the poets that you can,
yeah,
what are some of the writers that are really inspiring you currently, poets or not?
Last night, every poet who touched the stage at the You Speak Slam, I now follow them on Twitter. Like, these are kids that are ages 13 and 19, and I'm obsessed with them. Like, they just, there's nothing like a You Slam that just puts so much faith in my humanity for me. Like, just watching them tell their stories and basically schooling adults and being like, yo, this is my life. Don't tell me how to live it. Just being so sassy and bold and so proud and strong and amazing and then inspiring people their own age. Like, that's definitely it. So the poets last night, absolutely amazing human beings. So the youth always inspire me, being one myself and at one point. And then as well being the pleasure of coaching and mentoring for You Speak Seattle. And then I love Tara Hardy, Karen Fernie Frog, Rachel McKibbins. I love Seamus Haney, the late great Jack McCarthy. I'm always inspired by my friends who are poets, Raven, Dante, Ella Barton. My mother, who's not necessarily a poet, but a phenomenal writer, just in general. Kathy Kane's K-Dot is great. And I'm, of course, right now obsessed with Kendrick Lamar. I mean, his new album, To Pimp a Butterfly, is just, oh, he's just an artist. He is adorable. He's all 5 feet and 6 inches of him. He's just great. I love him. But I'm really inspired by them. I'm reading a book called The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. I can't remember the author's name, but I'm convinced that it's this generation's In Cold Blood in the sense of how he writes it. Because it's not a memoir and it's not an autobiography, but it is. It's about this guy who, I don't want to give it away because you just should read the book. Just read it. It's about a guy who's roommates with this kid, Robert Peace, who just had this really wild, crazy life that you would never believe. Like, you're just kind of like, this could never happen to one kid. In the span of 30 years, this could never happen to one kid. And it does. And it's a phenomenal book. And I'm just completely blown away by the narrative and how he wrote it. I'm obsessed with it. But for poets, I'm always and forever going to be inspired by the youth poets that go up there and compete every year. Always. So.
Awesome. You are so engaging, and I'm just like, stop, don't stop talking. Oh, I have to ask a question now. Okay.
Trust me, I love talking. That's my whole thing. The reason why I'm doing comedy now is because that's getting paid to talk. My talk is not cheap. It's expensive. Well, not yet. I can't really charge too
soon.
Much quiet. Soon.
I do want to mention that you're hosting the Seattle Poetry Slam,
yes.
Grand Slam, at Town Hall,
mm-hmm.
May 2nd, 7:30.
Yep. Doors at 6:30, show starts at 7:30, but it's poet time, so the show probably started around 8, because the one thing about poets is we can always be under time, we just can't be on time.
Right.
You know, we could be the 3 minutes and 10 seconds, but we can't be, like, on time. It's poet time. But, yeah, so it's May 2nd, Town Hall, hosted by myself, featuring poets Imani Sims and Roberto Escalon. It's going to be really great, and I'm hosting. I'm really excited. It's my old stomping ground. It's going to be fun. I love hosting poetry slams. It's great. It's going to be goofy. I'll be doing I don't know if I'll do some doing poetry, but I'll do some comedy in between.
Nice.
And we'll see. Maybe I'll read a poem. I don't know. Still trying to figure that out.
Yeah. Well, before we move away from poetry into your other writings, I wanted to talk about my favorite poem of yours, which is the Lady Macbeth persona poem.
Yes.
Can we talk about that?
Yes, yes, yes. So this poem called A Woman's Will, it is the, what I think is the prelogue to the Macbeth play that I feel at one point Macbeth probably was like, the whole idea came from the fact that, like, what if Lady Macbeth and Macbeth got a divorce?
Right.
There would be no play, right? So I have this thing where Macbeth maybe kind of had, like, a midlife crisis moment in the middle of their marriage where he was like, I want a divorce. And she was like, no. So I write the monologue of her telling him, no, you're not going to divorce me. And it branched from a workshop that I do with high school kids and my former students where I have them choose a fictional character in literature and have them write a monologue to get on a reality TV show.
Nice.
So this was Lady Macbeth's monologue to get on a TV show called The Bad Girls Club. And The Bad Girls Club is literally taking girls who are bad girls, people who fight and drink and aren't ladies technically, and they just give them a lot of alcohol. Let them, like, catfight. It's really awful.
It's a real thing?
It's a real thing.
It's a real thing.
It's a guilty pleasure of mine. It's an awful show. I cringe as a feminist to watch it, but, like, I'm obsessed with it. But, yeah, so it's my interpretation of how Lady Macbeth would get on the Bad Girls Club with this monologue. But, and I'm a Shakespeare nerd. I mean, I grew up with Shakespeare. I've slept through more Shakespeare plays than people have actually seen. Like, I used to be the usher for the Seattle Shakespeare Company. My mom was on the board, and she forced my sister and I to be ushers. And then without a doubt, I just fell in love with it. Not knowing, you know, the person that I would turn out to be today, I mean, how can you not fall in love with Shakespeare? I mean, the man knows language. The man knows women. Like, he gets it. I mean, if you read anything of Lady Macbeth, you understand the man knows women. So that's where I kind of came from in that piece is particular. So, yeah, if Macbeth ever said, yo, I want a divorce,
I know exactly what she would say. What are some of, can you give us some of the other, because you are an educator as well. Mm-hmm. What are some of your favorite exercises to throw at writers?
Ooh. I really like the one where I tell them to, anything that kind of pulls in old school and pop culture, I try to pull those two together. I always like telling poets, one of my favorite exercises is I make them write pickup lines. Like, come up with your own pickup lines, rewrite a pickup line, make it something good, and then just basically turning pickup lines into full throttle poems. I really love that exercise. The exercise where you tell them that, you know, you're told that you're young your entire life, but, like, come up with a list of 10 things that you know to be true, that without a doubt you know this to be true. And then I have another one where it's, like, tell me the color of your mother's laugh, and then they go into that. And then another one where it's, like, write the directions to freedom, which I always think is a really good one to start with high school kids because they are, like, that concept always, they always are, like, what? What do you mean directions to freedom? And then once you just talk about it, like, self-definitions of freedom and so on and so forth, they're, like, really into it, and they just get into it. And then, of course, I always and forever will pull in the fact that, you know, rap stands for rhythmic American poetry, rhythm and poetry. So I always am like, okay, write a rap. Like, write a rap where you can't cuss. You don't necessarily need to rhyme. And then, you know, I tell them to write Shakespeare raps. You know, write a rap as though you're Hamlet, or write a rap as though you're Helena, or so on and so forth. And then, of course, my always and forever is just a persona poem. Choose someone that you've always wanted to write their voice. Someone, inanimate objects are always really fun. One of my favorite students wrote a poem about a pencil sharpener. And he had this great line where he's like, I am a pencil sharpener. And I asked myself, what's the point? And I was like, Jeremy, this is brilliant. I was like, that's such a great line. And so, you know, you get these weird exercises out, and then those kids just run with it. And every time I do it, I learn something new about the exercise and I tweak it. And, oh, this doesn't work and that doesn't work. And then, of course, always there's another one I do where I make them listen to three different songs. One is a hieroglyphic song, one is a Adele song, and the other one's a CeeLo Green song. And they're all about home. And then I have them write a poem in response to either of those, where you're either writing a letter to Adele and telling her about your hometown, or you're writing a letter to CeeLo Green and being like, this is my hometown. So there's that exercise too.
I want to try all of those right now.
Do it, yes.
Pause, please. No, kidding. So you recently released a series of three posts called The Tinder Tales.
The Tinder Tales.
What was the inspiration for that project?
So I moved to Los Angeles. I live in Los Angeles now. And I joined, absolutely so happy to be part of the Frank151 family online blog and publication. We come out with a quarterly book. I love them. And I was talking to my boss and mentor, Lily, and we were just talking about Tinder. For those who don't know, it's an app where you literally judge a book by its cover, and it's just completely either Tinder yes or Tinder no. I'm pretty sure there's going to be an STD called Tinder in a couple of years because of this app.
Right.
It's ridiculous. So I wrote the Tinder Tales because I was telling her one of my stories, and she was, like, dying and laughing. She's like, that's not true. That didn't happen. I'm like, I promise you. I have the evidence. I have the pictures. I have the posts. I have everything. She was like, okay, cool. Let's do it. Let's do a three-part series called The Tinder Tales. And I was like, okay, cool. And I did one, and it got a really good response. I did a second one, and response got even bigger. And then I did the third and final one, and the response got so big that my editor and publisher were like, let's just turn this into a book. Like, let's just do your, like, write about your dating life. And being single in a city like Los Angeles is hilarious. The material comes to me. You know what I mean? Like, LA is full of actors who will pretend to be your boyfriend. Like, it's just endless amount of material. And I absolutely love it, and it's great. And yeah, so it started off as kind of a joke, and now it's turning into like going to be a collection of short stories.
Which is called No Sympathy for Pretty Boys.
No
right?
Sympathy for Pretty Boys.
And
yeah.
When do you have an estimated date when people might be able to
probably
read
I want to go, I want to say this time next year.
Sure.
Yeah. I like giving myself due dates. Duke Ellington once said, don't give me time, give me a deadline. Could not agree more. Love you, Duke. So I'm going to say sometime next year, I'm collecting. And the funny thing is I have most of the stories already. Like,
right.
I don't need to make up in a lot of this stuff. A lot of this is just real. And then, of course, there's going to be a series where I'm like, there's two or three stories of me and a friend talking and them telling their Tinder tales. I have a male friend and I talking about Tinder, and then I have a female friend and I talking about Tinder. So I'll have those stories in there as well.
So I've read the first two of the
yes.
Tinder Tales. I look forward to reading the third. But let's dig into that second one for a second. And this was a guy who you were having a conversation about gender equity and pay.
Richard the Dick. Yes, Richard the Dick. How can I forget him? We were talking. You don't understand, Katie. He was amazing. This guy was like, on paper, he was flawless. He had an amazing job, he dressed well, he was extremely good looking, he was smart, until we're having coffee, and he straight up was like, I don't know how we got on the subject. Isn't that always that's always the story.
Right.
I don't know how we got on the subject, but we started talking about, like, equal pay, and he said this thing where it's like, you know, I don't understand, like, why women think that they deserve equal pay. They haven't been in the workforce as long as men. And I just was like, and he said it, and I, like, smiled, like, and I was like, wait, what? Like, I had that moment where it was like everything paused. And I did the, like, loudest eye roll ever, because he continued talking, but he could sense something had shifted.
Right.
Like, he could tell, like, oh, I'm definitely not getting some. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, I feel like he was thinking with his dick, and then basically it was like, oh man, we're losing. We're not going to get any tonight. Like, they just knew. His entire body knew that I was just, like, completely turned off and so confused. And of course, in the moment, I couldn't articulate. No, fuck that. I didn't have to articulate why that was a misogynistic, fucked up thing for him to say. But he demanded it, and all I could, like, think back was, like, you're an asshole. And he called me a child, and I called him a jerk. And so we had this, like, going back and forth, like,
right.
Stupid embarrassing, in a coffee shop on Melrose. Until finally I was just like, I'm leaving. Like, I think I just, like, finished my coffee, and I was like, I'm gonna go take a nap. I was like, I think maybe you should take a nap, too. And then he asked if he could take a nap with me. And I was like,
no.
The one thing I give it to men, though, is persistence. Oh, God, they don't give up. I love that. You just don't give up.
So I haven't read the third one yet, but we were having a conversation before we started recording about dick pics.
Dick pics. I don't get it. I don't get, like, okay, I've literally talked to a lot of my female-identifying friends and female friends, and we just don't understand it. Like, look, I enjoy a dick. I enjoy a good dick. It brings pleasure. It brings humanity. You know what
sure.
I mean? It, you create things with it. But I'm sorry. I'm not in love with it as much as you are. I'm not. I don't. Maybe because I don't hang out with it enough. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you're with your dick all the time. I don't hang out with your dick all the time, okay? And so you just feel as though this need that you can send it to me. Like, it's okay. I really, most of the women I know don't like dick pics. They're like, it grosses them out, right? Because they're like, what am I going to do with this? Like, women were hard to believe. I feel like sometimes we're more physical. It's like, okay, cool. Like, pictures, you know, they do something, but not really. I can't
right.
do anything with a dick pic. I can't. I'm going to delete it. It's weird. And so, like, for men, they just love that shit. And then I think, you have a phone full of photos of your dick. Like, you have a junk drawer of your junk on your phone. None of this makes sense to me. It's just, oh my God, it's so gross. And I don't understand unsolicited dick pics. Just ask. And then if you're uncomfortable with asking, you've got to be uncomfortable with sending me your dick then. Like, just ask. Some girls might like it. I haven't yet met a girl who admits that she likes it. I've had friends that have been like, well, I've requested one. And it's like, okay, that's fine. And then clearly you're like at that point in your relationship where you're like, send me a dick pic. But most of the time, it's not like we wake up and like, we're like, oh my God, I hope I get one. You know what I mean? It's not like, it's not an acceptance letter to Harvard, okay? It's not. It's not even like a reblog on Twitter. I get more excited about reblogs on Twitter than I do about getting a dick pic. But basically, without giving the article away, this boy who I thought was normal, they all seem normal, right? Because he had a normal job. He did like IT, but I guess ITs are the biggest freaks, I guess. I don't know. Anyways, he just out of nowhere, no hello, no what's up, just straight up.
Here's my dick.
I was eating a Costco hot dog. It did not ruin Costco hot dogs for me because you could never ruin a Costco hot dog. Costco hot dogs are the best thing on the planet. $1.50 with free refills. Trust me. Put a Costco hot dog against anything. I will always choose Costco hot dog. Always and forever. But it didn't ruin it for me. But he just sent me his dick out of nowhere. Ugh, it ruined it for me. It was awful. And then I immediately just like, I think I saw it, I squealed and like threw my phone. And I was like, ah! Like, I was like, I don't know what to do with this! And like just threw it. And then like had to do that thing where I like slowly grabbed my phone and like tried to delete it with like
not looking
at it. It wasn't even pretty. Like, he didn't even put like a nice Instagram filter on it. You know what I mean? Like, he didn't even try to edit it. It's like, it just like woke up. He was like literally
look.
Okay, I woke up this way only works for like Beyonce. Okay, not your dick at all. But yeah, so it's the third one's all about dick pics. And I'm kind enough that I give a list of things you should send instead of a dick pic.
And I love this. Can you give us some examples? If men are wondering what kind of pictures to send to a lady that they are courting.
If you're courting me, I would love, your friends and family might be tired of your food pics. Send me a food pic. I love food. Do it. Send me a Costco hot dog. Done. That's the best dick pic ever, is a Costco hot dog photo. Maybe a Costco hot dog in your lap, insinuating that it is your dick, but it's Costco hot dog. Sold. The other one is your hands doing something really, like, you know, useful, like putting our our future IKEA furniture together. Another one is maybe you at your job. Okay, that would be great to see you at your job. A, it's a little weird that you want to take a selfie at your job, but B, thanks for the effort. I love to see you in a uniform. And then the bottom of your socks. I need to know how dirty your apartment is. Like, do you use your socks to basically dust up your house? Like, are you straight up just gonna have like that silhouette of like just a black foot on the bottom of your white socks? Send me a photo of the bottom of your socks. I need to know. I don't have like a foot fetish. I just feel like that's a really useful thing.
Useful information.
Useful. It says a lot about a dude. Or send me your most used emojis. I can tell a lot by a human being by their like recent or most used emojis. Tell them. I'm like a palm reader. I know exactly who you are by like what emojis you use most.
I'm gonna show you.
Oh,
my recent emojis after when we're done with this, and I'm interested to see what my horoscope is. So there's another project that you've been working on for, I feel like, over a year called How to Love an Artist.
Yes.
What is this project all about?
So this project was starting off as, it was going to be a play, and it was going to be a series of short kind of vignettes and monologues and just whatever. And it started off as a project that I was in a relationship when I started it. And it was me and my boyfriend at the time. And, you know, we had this discussion about, you know, I feel like a lot of women, or no, better yet, just a lot of humans who identify as artists sometimes think that they're too much or they're not enough or they don't, you know, yeah, it's that agony that like, oh, I'm too crazy or I'm too whatever. No,
intense.
Too intense,
yeah.
Too passionate. Or my favorite, you're too sensitive. Shut the fuck up. No, I'm not. I'm just an artist. So I started off the project from like a series of conversations of, I was in an argument with my ex and he was like, man, I just wish I had just a playbook of how to love an artist. Like, how to love you. And I was like, wait. And I just remember doing in the middle of an argument, I was like, hold up. And like, pulling my notebook out. And he was like, okay, whatever. I'm just going to roll with this.
Right.
He rolled with the punches. Good boy. Roll with the punches for a bit. And so I started it as this kind of theory that I feel like, you know, as people who identify as artists, we love differently. But not in the sense of like, you know, I feel like everyone is an artist in their own way, but there are people who kind of are the forefront of being artists, that like they're artists full time, or that, you know, I look at you and I think, oh, Katie's an artist. You know, there's those individuals.
It's just part of the core of their identity, whether or not they're getting paid to do it or not.
Exactly. It's just, it's, you couldn't be who you are today if you didn't identify as being an artist.
Right.
Right? You said it better than I have. So it's basically that whole concept. And then I realized within interviewing different artists from different mediums that they love differently. And I've been doing this for over a year now. I have over 80 hours of interviews. I have over 200 questionnaires that have been answered. I know it's crazy in a year, because once you send it to one person, they're like, do you mind if I, and I'm like, go ahead, send it to whoever you want. And I'm constantly always taking on new people that are like really interested. And I've realized that different artists in their own subsets love differently. And it's not always true. There's outliers, of course, but dancers tend to love very physically, that when I ask them to describe their art, which is dancing, and then describe their lover or their loves or their family and friends, they tend to talk about the physical attributes,
sure,
of love. You know, like, one of the girls, I'm very good at keeping, like, when you submit something to me, I keep it very, it's purely research. I don't share any information. But for example, one of the girls, you know, I asked her to describe what love was, and she described her boyfriend's ribs, the way they, like, when he breathes, what they look like. And she was very big on, you know, the way he holds her. You know, she was very big on the, like, physical attributes. And then when I interviewed 4 male photographers, they were very, I hate to say it, point blank, they were very, like, love is this, love is not. Love is this, love is not. They were just very black and white with it, which is just so, I mean, as a poet and as a writer, just like, oh my God, the metaphor is just coming. You know, as a photographer, this is what it is for you. And then, of course, us poets, we're very saturated in metaphors and deep you know, thoughts that are just sound gorgeous, but I have no idea what the hell they're saying. Like,
what about, I wanted to, because I filled this out a while ago, and I remember it being a profound experience. I mean, I don't have a copy of what I sent, but that experience of, yeah, I have been told several times that I'm too much.
Yes.
Whether in a relationship or not in a relationship, you know, and it's a little devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally got, the last time I was in a relationship, and it ended about a little over 3 years ago, and being devastated by that, as I always am. Because I think, at least for me, there's so much of an investment going in. And I think maybe, for me personally, that comes from being a theater artist, and it's like, okay, your life is sort of dissected into these 6 to 8 week chunks, right?
Yeah.
When you're working on a show, and you just have to get there. You have to memorize your lines and make those connections and all of that. And that doesn't necessarily translate well to a one-on-one relationship with another human being.
No.
But it's, it was liberating to do that, and it's great to hear that there is raw data. Like,
yes, yes.
That other people,
proven.
You are not alone in the world. But did you draw any conclusions from theater artists or actors or?
You know, the funny thing is that I've tried, at first I just highlight whatever, the people who answer first is then, those are the ones that I just highlighted and just pulled inspiration from, contacted and further questioned and everything. But now I'm, like you said, I'm dividing it more in the subset. So it's like, okay, you know, if you identify as more than just one artist, you're in your own little et cetera pile. I'm going through the actors and actresses right now, and the one conclusion that I can pull from you guys is that you are constantly looking for the definition. That you're kind of like, I'm not sure. Can you tell me
what love is?
What love is?
We want to be directed.
Yeah, it's so weird. You guys want to be directed. And there's a lot of, you know, one of the actresses that I interviewed, I had the pleasure of interviewing in LA, is that she, you know, she was like, she was talking about her devastating, horrible breakup. And she just said, I just kept remembering telling him, like, tell me what to do. Tell me how to make this a good thing. Which I hear a lot of people do in general, but like, hearing that from an actress, I kind of was like, oh my god, that makes sense. Like,
well, I found that on the horrible Tinder date. I don't know. I haven't gone on a Tinder date, but I've gone on eHarmony and Mesh.com and OkCupid and Plenty of Fish. So many.
I love you for that.
Dates.
I love it.
And it is a little bit, it feels a little bit like improv to me.
Yes.
Where it's like, okay, what's the situation? What's the character? This is the character you would like me to play.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Most of the time I go on these dates, I know within the first 5 minutes that this isn't going to be anything more than this hour that we have right now. But it's interesting because there's also that obligation. I don't know. I'm a Midwestern girl. And so for me, I sort of, there's, I don't know, and I probably impose this on myself, this obligation of, well, this person's being nice enough to sit down with me and they will probably pick up the check for better or for worse. And so the least I can do is be pleasant for 60 minutes.
Oh my God, I'm the same way. I think it's also just a woman thing. Because we're, like, told that we have to, you know, I was joking with one of my guy friends earlier, actually before coming here, and I was like, yeah, you know, my job as a woman is to, like, be good at cooking, give men compliments, and, like, be pleasant. I'm good at least one of those things, and that's being pleasant. But it is that obligation that you feel like it. It's not necessarily true, and in fact, it's not true at all, but I feel the same way. Like, when I'm on a date, I can tell right away, like, oh, this is going awful. Or this is going really well, or we're gonna be friends. You know, like, and it is improv. I think that's the best way, because it's a lot of this, okay, yes, and I'm committing, and I'm gonna run with it. Sometimes when I'm bored on a bad date, I'll just try to slip in an Irish accent and see if they even fucking notice. And sometimes they don't, and then sometimes I'll just wipe it away, and then sometimes
can we
I'm
hear some of your Irish accent? You
so
do?
I'll teach you how
to
do an Irish accent.
Yes,
okay, so, how now, brown cow, becomes hi nay ranke, and then the way you gotta do it is just everything gotta sound like a question, even if it isn't. And then if you just add fuck every time, you know, just fuck turns into like a comma. And it's really funny because apparently one time I was in a fight with my ex and I got a fucking Irish accent. And he was like, where the fuck did that come from? Just really thick. Except it probably sounds really bad right now.
It sounds awesome. And you get that from your father's Irish.
My father's Irish. He was born and raised in Ireland. I am an anchor baby, proud to say it. But yeah, my dad was born in Belfast. And so my entire father's side, my mom's Irish and Norwegian, and my father's side, they all have thick Irish accents that I can't hear. You know what I mean? Like, I'm so used to an Irish accent that, like, I met someone in LA who was from the same neighborhood as my father, and someone was like, where's your accent from? And I, like, looked at him like, you have an accent? Like, I just couldn't hear it.
Right.
Northern Irish accents, it's a whole nother language, I can tell you that. But I can't recognize it. But I can pick it up all the time. It's really easy. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph.
Jesus, Mary,
and
Joseph.
Ah, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, and a little monkey too. Oh, fuck me. But yeah, it slips. When I'm bored, I slip it in dates in and out. And see, sometimes I don't even notice.
Oh, yeah. Putting an accent on every once in a while is fun.
It's great.
So we haven't really touched on your comedy as much as possibly we
but
should.
But we have, because I'm talking. You're funny. I don't have an ego. I just have gorgeous confidence.
I love it. What has been, I don't know what, how do I want to ask this? So coming from slam poetry, and it kind of reminds me a little bit of my interview with Danielle.
Love Danielle.
Sorry, Danielle's amazing. That whole, do you think that slam poetry and doing that and having that in your bones helped propel you into stand-up comedy? Or what was that transition like for you?
So one of the, a girl in You Speak Seattle, she's also a poet now, her name's Raven Taylor, I call her my little sister, mentored her since she was 16, absolutely love her. She's been really interested in getting in comedy, and I've been describing it to her last night and earlier today that there is a lot in common with slam poetry and comedy. It's weird, the worlds just kind of meld together. You're constantly judged, and slam poetry you're judged by five random judges, and comedy you're just judged by judgmental people who come to comedy shows, you know?
Right.
And you know what works in slam poetry the same way you know what works in comedy. Like, I can go into a poetry slam and be like, oh, these people want something lighthearted, or I can go into a poetry slam and think like, oh, these people want that really kind of like deep-rooted poems.
Yeah.
You know, you can kind of feel the audience out. And same thing in comedy. Like, you know, like, what's going to do well and what's not going to do
right.
well. And going to a lot of comedy shows, I've been to a lot in Seattle, but of course, since moving to LA, I just go to them all the time. Just, oh, this comedy show? Just go and watch. Because, like, a student of poetry, I know to be a better poet, you just watch other poets. So to be a better comedian, you just watch other comedians. And so there is this feeling you kind of get where you can feel out both of them and assess the situation and see what works and what doesn't work. And you know people who bomb in poetry, and you know people who bomb in comedy. In the same way that, like, when people find out I'm a spoken word poet or a slam poet, I'm always like, but I'm not that poet. You know what I mean? Because you automatically think of the poet who talks like this, and is really mad sometimes. Like, so there's, like, that where I'm like, I'm not that poet, I promise you. But they exist, you know? And so it's like that in comedy, where as a female comedian, and people find out you're a female comedian, you find yourself being like, but I'm funny. I shouldn't have to say that. You know? Like, it's I'm a female comedian. No, I'm just a comedian. Like,
right.
I identify as a female comedian, but I feel like people, it's kind of like when you hear a slam poet, you've already assumed so much of that, like that voice. The same way that when you hear a female comedian, the assholes and jerks of the world already assume she ain't funny. Or you're going to do, like, period jokes.
What's your response? This is one of my favorite questions to ask Danielle. What's your response to people who say, who truly believe in their bones that women aren't funny?
If it's coming from a dude, your mom is the funniest person in the world because she gave birth to a joke.
Oh!
Like, straight up. That's what I think. It's like, okay, but it's your mom. She gave birth to you and you're a joke. That's just because, that's just, like, my one, like, yeah, son, like my one rap lyric to them.
Right.
I can't take them seriously. You know, like, I just, when someone's like, I don't think women are funny, I'm just kind of like, okay, who told you you could talk? Like, I just, like, it just confuses me so much. It's this weird definition and just, not even stereotype, this weird urban legend that I feel like a very, very insecure man came up with.
Right.
And then just perpetuated it. You know, I forgot who says it, but, like, you know, a lie will run across the world before the truth can get its pants on. And that's where I think the whole, like, women aren't funny, like, that got out first before
right.
women are funny or just people are funny or, you know. And, of course, there's bad female comedians the same way that there's bad male comedians. It's just true. But I cannot take anyone seriously, man or woman, who says women aren't funny. It's like, shut up. No one asked you to say anything. No one asked you to talk.
Sit down.
Sit down. Go away.
I know that you and I both share a deep love for Saturday Night Live.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it.
I love it all.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it a lot.
Channeling our, getting our Molly Shannon on.
Yeah.
what would you say your comedic influences are currently?
I love Amy Schumer.
I was gonna, when you were doing that whole dick pic thing, I'm like, that, I could totally see that being a bit an inside Amy Schumer.
I love Amy Schumer. I think she is just brilliant. And she is my, like, the huge thing about, this is kind of a subtopic, but going to get back to your question.
Sure.
Amy is one of my best examples of the idea of rape jokes. You know, it's like, when is it okay? When is it not okay? You know, my whole thing of just about jokes in the world is it just better be funny. You know what I mean? Like, with the whole controversy with Trevor Noah, like, his jokes, they're not even funny. So, like, of course they're anti-Semitic and awful and rude because they're not funny.
They're
dude.
Poorly written.
They're poorly written jokes. Like, you gotta make me chuckle. If you're gonna insult me with a joke, it better be funny. Like, you know, I've heard them all, right? But, like, if you're going to... if you're going to commit to being a comedian, you might as well write funny jokes. And Amy Schumer is just the one that I always am like, when people are like, do you think rape jokes are funny? And I'm like, if they're funny. Like, Amy Schumer's one about rape, about how there's a gray area with rape. And I'm just like, that's not only funny, it's brilliant. Because it gets the conversation started. It makes people, certain people feel uncomfortable, and it's like, okay, very obvious that you're the people that don't want to talk about it. You know,
right.
Like the same people who don't want to talk about racism or whatever. It's like, she just gets it. And I feel like, of course, she is someone who's worked at it. You know, she's failed,
right.
And then now she's successful. But yeah, she's someone I really admire. I embarrassed myself in front of Maya Rudolph. I had the opportunity of meeting her.
What?
I know, this is so bad. This is so embarrassing. She was at Sasquatch, and I was telling my friends, they were like, what's the, you know, what do you want to do at Sasquatch? Like, what's your to-do list? So I was like, well, I want to see MIA, I want to see Outkast, and I want to meet Maya Rudolph. And they're like, ha, we're going to meet her. And we see her, and my friend, like, turns to me and goes, okay, Rose, Maya Rudolph is over there. We're going to go up to her and we're going to talk. So my friend Mary goes ahead of me and is like, hi, Maya. It's so nice to meet you. I want to introduce you to your biggest fan. And, like, before it could get out of Mary's mouth, she just mouths, what the fuck is wrong? I am hiding in my hoodie. I'm crying. And I'm, like, hyperventilating. Cause I'm like, and I hate to be, like, that fangirl.
Right.
You know what I mean? But it was just this moment that I was, like, totally joking. Like, I'm going to meet her. And then there she was.
Right.
And, like, I already had the classic line. I was going to be like, hi, Maya Rudolph. My name's Rose Macleish. You're going to be my future boss someday. And then walk away. That was it. I was going to do that. Couldn't even do that. I was, like, freaking out. It was so embarrassing. My boyfriend at the time and my friends were just embarrassed. They were like, Rose, you look
sorry,
like
Maya
hottest.
Rudolph.
And even Maya Rudolph was like, oh, okay. I'm going to see you guys at my show. And I was like, yeah. It was so bad. But I admire her so much. I think she's brilliant. And of course, you know, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey, Kirsten Wiig. I love, she's not necessarily, well, I feel like she's a comedian. She's a comedic writer. Gingy Cohen.
Yes.
Love her.
Yes.
I'm in my hair blue right now thinking of Gingy Cohen. I think she's a phenomenal, gorgeous woman. Who else? Lily Tomlin. Gotta give it
yes.
up to the greats. Lily. I mean, no one can do it like Lily. She just holds it down. I've become a big fan of Sarah Silverman.
Yes.
You know, she's interesting. It took a lot for her to grow on me. But I feel like she's...
I think it's really interesting to compare and contrast Amy Schumer and Sarah Silverman because
mm-hmm.
I think why I connect so strongly to both of them is that they self-identify as feminists.
Yep.
I think in her Entertainment Weekly interview recently, Amy Schumer, it's like, it wasn't what I set out to do, to be like the feminist comedian,
yep.
but it's the cause I'm most interested in supporting, so right on.
I'm gonna do it.
But I think both of them are doing so much for feminism and in such different ways.
Yes.
And I love that about both of them.
And it's because it's the whole fact that everyone thinks that feminism is one definition. And it's constantly evolving. It's constantly
personal,
changing.
Very personal.
I mean, I feel like with our moms and their generation of, like, feminism, it's completely different. Like, my mom still can't wrap around her head around the fact that, like, owning the word bitch and, like, reclaiming it. And that's totally fine. Like,
bitches get shit done.
Bitches get shit done. You know what I mean? And she's, like, learning that, and now she's embracing that. But
okay.
That ever-constant idea that feminism isn't hating men. It's just literally wanting equality. Like, I just don't get it when people are, like...
Yeah.
Don't confuse... Like, are confused. It's just... Yeah, it's just... Feminism is forever changing. And so when you have people like Sarah Silverman and Amy Schumer that are, like, clearly two different types but are headed to the right direction, then who am I to be like, nah, man, you're not my type of feminist. You are. You're doing your own thing. The same way that people think Beyonce is a feminist and isn't. The same way people think that Taylor Swift is a feminist and isn't. It's a constant conversation. It's ever growing. But in all honesty, it's just about equality. And just
yeah.
getting shit done. But yeah, so I'm just... Oh, Janine Garofalo.
Yeah.
I just want her to just...
Yes.
Like, just come on. Just take me. Just take me. Be my mentor. Be friends. I'll always love her from, you know, forever. Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion.
Yes.
Best. I love her so much. But yeah, that's kind of...
It's a great list.
It's a great list. It's a thick list. Oh, and Larry David. I want Larry David to be the Judd Apatow to my Lena Dunham. Or maybe I should be the Judd Apatow to his Lena Dunham. I love Larry David. And then John Oliver and John Stewart.
Yes.
Killing in the game.
Yes.
Oh, God. Well-educated white men. There's not enough of them. And you got John Oliver and John Stewart, and they just get it.
Bam.
Bam and bam. So, that's kind of my... I'm, of course, forgetting people.
Yeah. No,
and
it's
going to come to me, and I'm like, oh, wait. But, like, you know who you are. I'm forever evolving. But right now, that's kind of it. That's my radar.
So as we're sort of winding down our hour together,
what
I would like to do, the last question I would like to ask you is, I think there are these brilliant, feminist, strong artist types all over, and I hope some of them are listening. I know some of them are listening.
Oh, of course they are.
But... To a young woman, or not even a young woman, but to a woman, female artist, who's ever been told that she's too much, or difficult to love,
mm-hmm.
or any of that, can we just go out? I want, like, your message of empowerment.
My message? You want my rant?
Yes.
You want your awesome rant?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so here's the thing. This is what you're gonna do. You're gonna wake up, right? You're gonna get butt-ass naked, okay? You can either have the windows open if you want or not, but just wake up in the morning, get butt-ass naked. You're going to listen to Mary Lambert's Body Love. Then you're going to listen to, it's Alanis Morissette, anything actually from Alanis Morissette, because she was just, oh, Fiona Apple. You're going to listen to some Fiona Apple. You're going to listen to Kendrick Lamar's I. This is just going to be a mixtape that you're going to listen to, and you're just going to dance around the room naked, and you're going to start chanting, I am my own Beyonce. And you're just gonna be a badass. But okay, that's just like what you're gonna do every morning. That's what I do every morning, if anyone wonders. But no, but like to your question, I think my advice to a woman and just wanting to be empowered is that, A, you're not alone. I know that we always, always come to that realization in deep depression and scary moments that we are alone. You're not alone. It's okay to feel alone, but you're not alone. Also, you are fucking amazing. I mean, even the fact of, like, getting up in the morning is the toughest thing in the world. Oh, you know, three of the girls that I mentor battled depression, and I always tell them, well, did you wake up? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, then you won. You won the day. You got out of bed. Even if the days that you don't get out of bed, that's okay. You woke up. Like, that just, waking up is literally the hardest battle sometimes. Also, be too much. You know, don't fit the box. Go out of the box. Don't try to fit someone else's definition of what beauty is or beauty isn't. Just do whatever the fuck you want, because the thing is you're gonna find your oddballs. You're gonna find your Katies, and you're gonna find your, you know, Maya Rudolphs, and you're gonna find your, you know, whatever. You're gonna find those people. And it's going to be great, and it's going to be fun, and they're going to wear as awesome clothes as you, and they're going to smell good and, like, love the same food as you. But my biggest thing is just know that you're not alone, and just be too much. Fuck it. Just be as loud and as noxious and as goofy as you want to be. You'll come to the realization of just, okay, these are times where I need to be, and these are times where I don't need to be. And then just have fun. And, I mean, my number one thing in the entire world is, recently I've been able to laugh at myself more. It's just, fuck it. Just, whenever anything happens, just fuck it. Like, that's life. Just have fun. Is that a weird rant? That was, like, everywhere.
I loved,
like,
it.
A Kanye moment where I just had
it.
A lot of a tangent. Just have Kanye-fidence. When low, listen to a Kanye song.
Kanye-fidence. Is that yours?
It's a thing that I came up with as a joke, and then someone had it on USA Network. Like, USA Today had a website called KanyeFidence.com where it gave you Kanye West lyrics and Kanye West quotes to give you confidence. One of my favorite Kanye West quotes,
yeah.
Sorry, this is super random,
yeah.
Is, I am a god, so when people ask me what I am, I just told you I am a god. It's like, oh, fuck, yes, Kanye. Yes, I love you. But yeah, to anyone out listening there who's a young girl, be different. Be weird. You can only be you. I know it's cheesy and cliche, but there's only one of you. Everyone has at least 9 million stories in them. At least 9 million stories in them. And no one can tell that story but you. I can try as hard as I can, but I can't tell Katie's story. I can't tell Raven's story. I can't tell Ella's story. But they can tell their story. And I'm dying. I am dying to hear your story. I am.
I love it. I think that's a great note to go out on. If people should keep tabs on you and see,
yes,
the new things that you're up to, there's the website, which is rosemacalise.com. This will all be in the description of the podcast. And you're on Twitter, and that's at @Rose_EttaStone, ETTA. STONE.
Yep.
And on the Instagram and a Facebook page as well.
Yep. Instagram is the same thing. Rose @Stone. It's my rap name. I wish I was a rapper. It's my rap name. It's my Instagram. I have my Tumblr, which is the Intern Archives. I have my blog, which is just rosemacalise.com. My page, like me, Rose Macalise. And just talk to me. I like really weird people. And I like weird shit. Just hit me up. Let's be friends.
Let's be friends, and let's be weird people.
Let's be weird. Yay!